How do we define ourselves, Kansas City? Are we a community made of rich and poor, black and white? Are we defined and divided by the languages we speak at home? Do neighborhoods, suburbs, or rural communities signify who we are? I'm Laura Ziegler, and on today's Central Standard, we'll be exploring the ways our communities have and are changing. It's the beginning of a longer conversation between us and you about borders and boundaries in Kansas City. We want to know what you think. Are some of the most undercovered, maybe even unknown, boundaries we live with. And later in the hour, we'll be exploring the song, Going to Kansas City. That's all ahead after this hour's news. This is Central Standard. I'm Laura Ziegler. What is your community, Kansas City? How do you identify it? Do you identify it by where you live, where you work, where you worship, or where you play? If you're like most of us, you probably have more than one community. Today, we're going to take a start at what will be a long conversation on air and online with you about your communities. We're going to take a look at the lines that divide us and the lines that bring us together. We do have some iconic lines in our area. We have state line, of course, and many metro regions around the country have adjoining cities either side of state line, but our state line has some unusual aspects and implications for a number of important institutions, most notably education. We have Troost Boulevard, once a thriving center of daily life and commerce, today representing a legacy of discriminatory practices. Our metro region has expanded exponentially. Our demographics have and continue to alter our collective profile. With us this morning to talk about all this and more are Ron Jones, our Director of Community Engagement here at KCUR. Welcome, Ron. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here, Laura.
And Frank Lake, who's the Director of Research at Mid-America Research Council. How are
Regional
you, Frank?
Regional Council. Thank you.
Regional Council. And Bob Collins, former city manager, and now of Collins, Notice, and Associates. Welcome.
Welcome.
All right. Well, let's start out. We got a lot to cover here, but Ron, I'm going to start with you. You come back to us, I should say, from doing a lot of community engagement work with other distinguished public radio stations around the country. Let me throw this out. What is community engagement?
Well, community engagement for KCUR is actually a process of opening the station's doors, inviting the community to participate in the content that we produce and the conversations that we have each and every day. And you know, Laura, KCUR and other radio stations have actually been doing a form of community engagement for years and years. Talk shows are a form of community engagement. You know, we invite listeners in every day to talk about the things that we talk about on radio. So we're taking it one step further than that. We're actually mounting a concerted effort to get out into the community, to talk to people, to learn what matters most to their lives, and to bring that information back and incorporate it into the coverage that we provide.
Well, flesh out a little bit about what that approach, how that approach is different. What does it bring to our coverage that maybe hasn't been there in the past?
Well, we hope to bring a fresh approach, first and foremost, many new voices and new perspectives to our air. You know, there are many communities in our region that are underrepresented by media, meaning that media covers particular communities, but only when there's a story to report, and we parachute in, so to speak, only to return when there's another story. But we think there's a deeper way of covering the important issues and aspirations of our community. So we're actually going to get out into the community.
It's a ground-up approach.
It's a ground-up approach.
And we're going to be conducting some listening sessions, which people will hear more about as we go down the road a little bit. And we're putting KCUR, the public radio station, in a different relationship to the community, the broader communities, and then the communities that maybe we don't know exist.
That's true. It's all about discovery for for KCUR. You know, we're this is a little bit inside baseball, but internally we're learning new ways to cover subjects and to have conversations. So it's a fresh approach to the work that we do each and every day.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to hearing more about it. And I want to introduce at this time our two other guests, Frank Lenk, who's the Director of Research at the Mid-America Regional Council, and Bob Collins, former city manager in Kansas City, and now Collins, Notice and Associates. Thanks again to both of you for coming in.
Sure.
And before we get into the nuts and bolts of this conversation, I want to play a couple of tape clips. We conducted a conversation among a few stakeholders in Kansas City to sort of help us guide where we were going to go with this longer conversation that we're talking about here. And I'm going to start right now with the first of those tape clips. It's from I'm going to, by the way, ask a couple you all to react to those. So listen carefully. The first one is David Warm, who's the director of the Mid-America Regional Council.
75% of the poor people in greater Kansas City have access to transit, but they have access to only 20% of the jobs. And that's access is defined as a 90-minute bus trip, which is really no access at all. Mm-hmm. And so access and being cut off from opportunity is huge. If you were to take a single African-American mother with a high school education in Olathe, she statistically will be wealthier than the same demographic profile in Midtown Kansas City. Place matters, access matters, community stability matters, policy matters, educational opportunity matters.
Bob Collins, let me start with you. You've been involved in the politics and the administration of the city in the past. What do you make of what David Warm was saying in terms of lines that unite and divide us?
David's bringing up some of the major issues that urban areas face, both in terms of how to deal with the connection of people and jobs, and also dealing with those that are in poverty in the lower income areas of the community. What this community, I think, is facing is how to accomplish that and how to bring those groups closer together. And they're doing it in a number of different ways today. One is concentrating on the provision of jobs through entrepreneurship, through training, through those types of things. The other is on looking at various modes of transportation, increasing access, things like the streetcar, things like using the bus and the rapid bus system in this city, and trying to address some of those strong issues that not only deal with poverty, but with education, with healthy living, and healthy communities.
Frank Lenk, what do you, from a sort of demographic shift standpoint, what do you think about what David Warm said?
Well, I think he identified, a lot of issues in a few statements. And, one of them is the concentration of poverty that still exists and that it's still has a racial tinge to it. But counterbalancing that is there are now more poor people in the suburbs than there are in the two central cities. And so the region as a whole has continued to spread out. That makes it harder to serve with things like transit. Transit is built around density. At the same time, we see in certain places, areas are redensifying and maybe being better able to be served by transit. So along that streetcar corridor, it's possible, we already see some reinvestment occurring, and that reinvestment will make transit even more successful.
Areas are redensifying. Are you talking about downtown and midtown people moving back down there? Is that what you're referring
to? Yeah. So, in my head, I have this this map of the region, and for the first time around downtown, there was net population growth for the first time in 30 or 40 years. And that's to a large extent the reinvestment that's occurring in the around downtown and the Crossroads area and so on. And, the question is, can we make that grow and stretch out, across that truce boundary that you mentioned and really have it be, a source of strength for the entire region?
Bob Collins, you heard David Warm say that access is defined as a 90-minute bus ride. From an administrative / political standpoint, what does that tell you about how we're not understanding the needs of our communities?
The connection is for a 90-minute bus ride or a 30-minute bus ride is, do you have jobs and are people able to get to and from their home to their place of work or their school or their hospital? And the key, I think, is it safe, secure? Are people able to understand how to get to and from those places? 90 minutes is getting much farther in this community than it was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a map of Kansas City 20 years ago or 40 years ago, and you would compare how far you could get in a half hour or 20 minutes, in 1950 you could probably get from downtown to the plaza. Today, you can get from downtown to Olathe or Lenexa, or almost to St. Joseph in a lot of ways. And so time is important, but also the access and security.
But is 90 minutes a reasonable? I mean, if you have 90 minutes to and from your job, you're in transit 3 hours of your workday. Is that a reasonable expectation?
I don't think David was suggesting that that was an optimal travel time. He's saying that even if you extend the travel time to 90 minutes, still only 20% of the jobs are accessible to those who are poor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it shows you that where the poor are located
the kinds of jobs that are available to them
are spread out all over the region, and you really can't get there with transit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would add though that in the areas of concentrated poverty, they have pretty good bus access to jobs that are nearby, and they are close to the highest concentration of jobs in our region in the corridor that stretches between downtown and the plaza. But many of the jobs that are available in those corridors are ones that they are not able to do because of an educational barrier, a skills barrier, not because of a physical barrier or a transportation barrier.
Okay, interesting. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Laura Ziegler, and we're talking today about the lines that unite and divide us in the metropolitan area. You just heard the voice of Frank Link, who's the Director of Research at Mid-America Regional Council. Also with us, Bob Collins of Collins, Notice & Associate and a former city manager in Kansas City. And, of course, our own Ron Jones, Community Engagement Director at KCUR. We want to hear from you, Kansas City. Join our conversation about boundaries that separate us and unite us. What do you see as those boundaries? Where are some of the lines that we might not recognize or are undercovered? Call us 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, or email us centralstandard@kcur.org. Let me go to another tape clip here. Right now we're going to hear from Diane Cleaver, who many people probably recognize. She is has had a number of leadership positions in Kansas City. Currently, she's the director of the Neighborhood Initiative, United Neighborhood Initiative. And here's what she had to say.
I think one institution that becomes kind of a focal point for a lot of these issues is the Kansas City, Missouri Public Schools. You know, it's a microcosm, or maybe bigger than a microcosm, of all these issues, race, poverty, you know, what patterns of intentional discrimination have done over the years. I mean, why is Kansas City, Missouri in 16 different school districts? You know, why were we designed that this one school district was in the middle? So I think a lot of the issues play out there. And, you know, what issue in our community is more difficult to address than moving the Kansas City, Missouri school district forward?
Frank Lick, let me come right to you because it speaks to the point that you just made earlier. The concentration of jobs are in Midtown, downtown, but lower income people who have not had a lack of education don't have access to those jobs. And the school district plays right into that problem, no?
Correct. So I should make two points. One is there's a lot of jobs there. There's still probably not enough jobs in that area. It's not a successful enough corridor to really provide jobs to everyone who would want one that's nearby. And so that's one reason why the poor are not able to get jobs. But there's also this educational barrier. And absolutely, you know, it starts frankly, well before they get into the KC Missouri School District. It starts at home. It starts in early ed and then the KCMO School District. And there's no question as you look around the country that if you create school districts of where they are highly concentrated poverty, especially minority poverty, they all have trouble. It's not unique here. And so what can you do about it? There are a lot of school intervention strategies. A lot of them involve wraparound support to aid families. There's a lot of single parents that don't have the time to spend with their kids because they're working two jobs. And so there's a lot of issues that sort of manifest themselves in the school but really take an entire community to solve. And one of the reasons why it's hard here is the dividing lines allow us to separate into us and them, and so that's their problem, it's not my problem. It makes it much harder to solve.
Bob Collins, what more specifically would you identify as the dividing lines created by our problems with the Kansas City, Missouri public schools?
I think what this community sees is a school district which separates itself from the rest of the community because of where it is and the demographic changes that have occurred in those communities. Frank talked about the changes in the numbers of people in some of those areas. Kansas City, Missouri School District has lost student population over the past 30 to 40 years. The areas that they live in have lost population in those areas. If you look at, as an example, the area around Armour, 40 years ago they had a population of about 40,000 people. We've recently done a study, and that area today has about 8,000 people living in that area. And so,
What are the north-south boundaries of that, like Broadway?
From Broadway over to Troost, and Troost North. In terms of neighborhoods, the Squire Park and the old Hyde Park and the Hyde Park communities used to have tremendous density. And like the rest of the Kansas City, Missouri School District at that time. And today, they've lost that population. And it puts stress on the school district because of numbers. We've also provided a situation where students and families have other opportunities to provide it for seeking education in those areas, private schools, charter schools, other private and religious schools. And so the situation the school district is how do we provide an education for those students that haven't chosen those other opportunities, and what can this community do to help that? There's one other thing I'd like to say is that education is not only important in terms of jobs, but in terms of the long-term health of a community. A lot of studies have shown that wealth and health are attributable to good early childhood education and being able to move forward in education throughout your life.
Yeah, that will definitely be a deep dive that we take into health disparities around the region. Frank, did you have something to add here?
Yeah, so I wanted to say, despite the fact that we have these dividing lines, I would say that what I've observed in my 35 years is those lines are becoming gradually more blurred. So the region is diversifying. There are many more minorities in suburban locations. As I said, poverty has decentralized to the point where there's more poor people in suburbs than there are in central cities. And so the us-them dichotomy is much harder to maintain these days. And as a result, we, I think, are beginning to understand at a deeper level that we really are in this together. We have to figure out some of these problems. It really is damaging to our overall competitiveness as a metropolitan area if we don't.
Kansas City, let us know what you think about some of the blurred lines between our communities and what challenges that creates. 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, or post your comments to Facebook or Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Let's listen to one more tape clip here. We have the Reverend Rick Behrens. He's the pastor of the Grandview Park Presbyterian Church in Kansas City, Kansas, and he wants to speak specifically to the changing demographic reflected in our immigrant community.
The challenges that the immigrant community faces, I think Diane alluded to it in some ways, in that if you talk about people who are shut out of the process of improving their communities and participating in that improvement of the communities, they are in a very unique position in our society in that they are completely shut out. And when I look at the great gains that our neighborhood has made, and when I consider that over the next 20 years, if those families stay there and if there's no movement on this immigration reform effort, we continue to have folks who are second-class citizens, who are completely shut out of the process of improving their community through voting, through participating in local elections, local political efforts. I don't see I don't see a really positive future there, because people need to have that power, and that's part of who we are as Americans.
Frank, let me just come to you with a specific question related to the immigrant population. Does it present challenges in terms of collecting data about our changing demographic?
Well, to a certain extent, a certain proportion of the region's populations don't speak English well. That makes it harder for them to participate, and just the general level of mistrust. If government forms appear in the mail, it's hard. Frankly, it's hard for everyone mm-hmm. these days, but it's especially hard for immigrant populations, I would expect. Having said that, they don't seem to be insurmountable. We get good, I think, data on the immigrant population. For example, our overall population growth. We have domestic migration from around the country, but also international immigration, and our domestic migration has been going down over time to the point that we would have no in-migration, net in-migration at all, if it weren't for the international migrants.
I'm not sure what you're talking about with domestic migration.
So if you move from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Kansas City, that's domestic migration. If you move from Mexico City to Kansas City, that's international migration.
Yeah.
Okay, so it
seems pretty self-explanatory. Sorry,
the domestic has gone net negative on us, and okay. So the only positive migration we are getting is international migration.
Huh.
And so,
people aren't moving into Kansas City from other cities.
Exactly. So more and more, we are dependent for our population growth on the immigrant population. In terms of overall population growth, minorities accounted for 2/3 of it. Wyandotte County is majority minority. So minorities and immigrants are an increasing share of our population. The fact is, we're all immigrants at some point. We're all immigrants. And so
yeah.
They tend to bring a new life to cities. I think they've been a net positive, certainly for KZMO and KCK. The second generations, when they come in, they may not be as well educated, but by the second and third generations, they are doing just fine.
Bob Collins, what sorts of either pressure points or advantages do the immigration question present from a strategic planning standpoint?
I think one thing you may have to look at is a opportunity, because people are coming into your community. We need to provide services for those that are in need of services. Not all immigrants are poor. They're coming into this community and providing skills and services that are absolutely necessary. And so this community needs to be more entrepreneurial, I think, in terms of going out and looking for ways to include new residents into this community and make them useful in terms of providing skills and for what we see as important in this community.
Bob, in other cities where I've lived, most notably Detroit and Chicago, a sector of the immigrant community has been very entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. They start new businesses and create jobs in their communities. Are we seeing the same thing in this region?
I think you are in this community. Hispanic community is very much like that. The Asian American community. A lot of Vietnamese community are starting jobs. You're seeing restaurants. You're seeing service industries. You're seeing manufacturing done by immigrant populations.
You know what? We're going to get to some calls from Fairway. Bob is calling, and he wants to ask you guys a question. Bob, you're on the air. Hey there.
Hi, thanks for taking – yeah, can you
bet. Sorry for the wait.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for taking my call. I would say one of the most important lines that I don't hear anybody talking about is the line especially for a person that's between 7 and 17 years old, the ones that can get online, that do have the internet in their home, they're able to advance so much more. You can take all of the slights from the last 100 years and multiply them by 5, and you have the equivalent disadvantagement for kids that can't be on the internet versus the ones that can. I think that's how important the internet is. And I heard on this radio show that a city had
said that if they had their own network, they were going to attempt to get their own network. And from the income from that network, from them administering it, they'd be able to eliminate a lot of their taxes and money that they need to get just because of the amount of opportunity for money. So that's kind of my point. I don't know if how a city might be able to help once they had their own internet. I think you could allow disadvantaged people to have free internet because, like I said, I think it's that important.
Okay. Bob, let me get a response from our callers. You're talking basically about the digital divide. Who wants to take that first? That's a big one.
Well, I think the caller raises a very important point, and that is that all of our society is relying on the internet and the digital information as a way to learn and as a way to access information. And so,
and the way to get a job.
And the way to get a job, the way to – and use it as a job in a lot of cases. And so the more a community can encourage and to facilitate knowledge about that, the better off a community is, especially in the younger – mm-hmm. Populations, because they're more able to learn quickly.
Right, and they've kind of, grown up with it.
I'd say a couple of things. The divide, I think, is getting better over time. Number one, more and more schools are going to one-to-one computers for their students. My wife works in a charter school in KCMO, and they have one-to-one computers for their students, so they can at least use them at school. And then the cell phone technology is getting cheaper, and everyone has access who has a smartphone. Mm-hmm. So it's not that it's inexpensive, but many, even poor children, are able to acquire such technology, even if it's not the first the latest generation.
Yeah, and there are a number of community efforts underway to bridge that digital divide. Connecting for Good comes to mind, and I know there are others as well. Well, we are going to take a short break here. We're going to be coming back. When we return, we're going to hear from KCUR's Allison Rollitz on the social media aspect of our metro-wide conversation on dividing lines. And at the end of our show, Susan Wilson launches a new series, Go Into Kansas City, with a talk about the iconic song with the same name. We're talking about lines that unite and divide us in the metro. Call us if you have questions, 816-235-2888. Let us know what you think on the subject. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter at KCURCST. Back in a minute. Well, winter is back. Welcome back, winter, for a little while anyway. This is Central Standard. I'm Laura Ziegler. Our guest today, Bob Collins of Collins, No Tyson Associates, and former city manager here in Kansas City. Frank Link, research director at the Mid-America Regional Council. Ron Jones, community engagement director here at KCUR. And we're talking about how do we identify ourselves, Kansas City? What are communities that maybe we're not thinking are communities? How do you identify your community? And what are the lines that divide and unite us? We're beginning a long conversation over the next few months, over the next many months on this topic, and we really are asking for your help to better understand these questions. Call us today to ask questions of our guests, 816-235-2888. 816-235-2888. Post your comments to Facebook or tweet us at KCURCST. Before we go any further, I want to bring in our social media director, Allison Rollitz, to talk about the social media aspect of what we're doing here. Welcome.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
You came here to highlight, to KCUR, to highlight and build up the media activity. You've been involved in journalism and social media for some time. You've had some training at NPR. Not a lot of newsrooms are sort of concentrating on using social media specifically in their journalism.
Well, I would say that there are a lot of newsrooms that have assigned certain people in those organizations to tweet out or to post content to Facebook. I definitely think that's happening all over the country. What we're not seeing as much of is a real emphasis on a community engagement, like using social media to engage those populations and to engage readers and listeners. And that is a growing trend, and that's something KCUR is trying to play a big part of in Kansas City.
So tell us a little bit specifically about how we're going to use, or we have been using, social media in engaging our community and doing our journalism?
Well, sure. First off, we're just being more active, and we're just kind of – we've opened our ears. We're really trying to listen to – when listeners ask questions on the air or online, we'd really try to respond and answer those questions. As people submit story ideas, as they just have questions about the content, we're really trying to respond. So that's kind of one step. We've also really tried with Tell Case You Are to kind of go beyond that and really think about the news of the week and ask a question. And it's really important to us not just to shout at our audience what we think the news is. We want to hear what they feel and what their experiences are on a certain topic. So we've started Tell Case You Are. It lives online and it lives on the air. We post the question out every week. We ask people what they think, and then they tweet us the answers. They call in the answers, and they also post the answers on Facebook. And a big part of that is we just don't say, yay, thank you for talking to us. We collect all that feedback, and we share it with the community again. So I think really people really get a kick out of hearing what their coworkers and friends and colleagues have to say about a certain topic.
At KCUR is our Twitter handle.
Yes, definitely.
And then there are hashtags that relate to whatever the question is of the day. And we try and, like you say, talk about what people are talking about.
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
what we're trying to get a sense of.
Yeah, we ask people to specifically, for our Tell KCUR questions, to ask to use the hashtag Tell KCUR. And that just helps us follow the conversation.
I'm going to just quickly ask Ron Jones to talk a little bit about the role of social media and other community engagement efforts that you've been involved in at your other stations.
Well, it takes on many different forms. I just recently moved back here from Metro Detroit, and community engagement was very much a part of our station activities. It ranged from a question of the day that we asked to, inviting people to participate in on-air and online book clubs, to asking people to weigh in on different issues in the form of polls, and also a pretty robust talk show presence. So it manifests itself in many forms.
So the idea is, all of you out there in our listening audience, to engage you to the extent you are active online or you are active on Twitter, to engage with us, respond to stories that you hear, respond to posts that you see on Facebook, make comments, and let us know what you think about how we're doing. It's really kind of a new role for public radio in relation to the communities it serves. What about this week's Tell KCUR, Allison?
Well, this week's Tell KCUR is a really good example of what we're trying to do here at the station. For the past 40 minutes or so, we've had a really vibrant discussion on this talk show about the lines that divide us in Kansas City. And so we want to kind of take this conversation. We want it to live past the time Central Standard ends today. We want it to live all week. So what I'm asking on the air today is the same question that we're going to be asking all week online on Facebook, on our website, and on Twitter. So this week's question is, what are Kansas City's metro's strongest geographic dividing lines? How do they affect your life? And we really want folks to let us know so we can tell everyone else. And this is also helping us in the beginning process of this conversation that we're starting in the coming months. So how can you help? How can you tell us? Well, you could just call us if you wanted. You could call the number 816-235-2881. And we listen to those voice messages very carefully. We end up playing some of them on the air. You also could tweet us. You could just have to use the hashtag TellKCUR. And then that helps us follow the conversation. We follow the answers that way. We retweet you. We ask you questions. We really try to start a dialogue. We don't want to just listen to your answer and then end it at that. Also, right now, the question is posted on KCUR's Facebook page, so just go onto Facebook, search for KCUR 89.3 FM. The question is there. Leave a comment, and that will be up there all week at the top of the page. Just leave your comments there. And at the end of the week, basically Thursday, we're going to gather all these responses. We will post them in a summary online, and then I will be back on the air on Thursday during this program, kind of giving about a 5 to 10 minute spiel about this, hey, this is what people said. These are the dividing lines. And the great thing is it's you all are driving the news. It's not us telling you the news.
Which, as you said earlier, Ron, is really an integral part of this conversation that we're talking about over the next year, about dividing lines and uniting lines. We are really looking for input from people, and we're going to be going out into the community and asking questions because we recognize that there are a lot of things that we don't know about your communities.
Yes. We arrived at this place where we figured out that collectively people in the community know more than we know here in the station. And what a concept, right?
So the journalists tend to be a little bit arrogant in that regard,
yes.
I think, sometimes.
So we're relying on you to inform us as we do our reporting and our coverage.
So, KCUR, you can call us now, 816-235-2888. You can get in on this conversation for the rest of this hour, tweeting us at KCURCST or find us on Facebook. Let's hear from Bill in Brookside, who has a question for our guests.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Thank you.
Sorry for the wait.
No problem. I appreciate the opportunity. I would like to comment on the question of how much the lines are blurring, and along the lines that at the same time that diversity, I think, is distributing the difficulty of gradients along the digital divide, there's a counter phenomenon which to me looks a lot like the traditional way of doing things. Almost naturally reasserting itself. And I think a very specific example that I would encourage people to look at is, in light of this conversation, if you guys could see out the studio across the street there, across Cruz, you would see the Kauffman Foundation. And as you may know, this past weekend there was a rather long article interview with Tom McDonnell about the direction and perception that the foundation is taking.
He's a former chairman of the board.
And now president, the CEO. Mm-hmm. I think that if you read that article, it's a rather mixed bag in terms of whether or not they are in a position of listening to the community about what is needed, or they're in a position where foundations believe they know what is needed and they're sort of leading with the idea that they have the resources and people like Connecting for Good are expected to follow. And this is something I've been looking at for a long time, so I have some rather clear opinions, but I certainly hope that in the course of this community engagement effort that the radio station is taking on, that it will get around to looking at why, for instance, in that long article, there's no mention of the Coos Corridor and all of the neighborhood and corridor development that's going on there, or vis-a-vis Central Avenue in Wyandotte County, which is, to me, is the Hispanic counterpart of the Coos Corridor. There are a lot of fairly mature experiments in revitalizing neighborhoods and corridors that haven't really yet broken into the awareness of the powers that be, despite things like the Urban Neighborhood Initiative and so on.
Yeah, Bill, let me, we're sort of running out of time. Let me give our guests a chance to respond. I think that part of what Tom McDonnell is trying to do at the Kauffman is to focus more locally. That's what I took away from the article. I think he's recognized that Kauffman did have more of a national focus, and he's trying to bring that in a little bit more to see what problems need to be addressed in Kansas City. And also I will say to Bill that that notion of Central Avenue and what's going on Troost will absolutely be a focus of some of our reporting, of our listening sessions. So we are going out to find out what people think about what's going on there. Bob Collins, a response to Bill's remarks?
I agree with you. I think Kauffman's signal that they are wanting to be more involved in Kansas City and in the community that surrounds them is a very positive statement from them. They've always done that, but I think people had the perception that they are not a local foundation. Their interest in entrepreneurship has led Kansas City, both schools and in the business community, to a lot of different things that are very meaningful. The Million Cups concept.
Yeah, every other Wednesday.
Every
people.
Other Wednesday.
Is it every Wednesday?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought it was every.
Which brings, you know, thousands of people together to talk about those issues. He does bring up the issue of what's going on Troost, which is very positive.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of both study and commitment. Mid-America Regional Council has done corridor studies to talk about sustainability and how to integrate transit and how to make it a more green corridor and how to infill development. Truman Medical Center is taking on the issues of how to make the community healthier by providing grocery stores. State Avenue on the Kansas side is doing the same types of things. And so I think Kaufman's interest in taking on some of those issues is very valuable for Kansas City.
Frank?
I would say, though, their focus really is on education and
Kaufman.
On Kaufman's mm-hmm. and not so much community development.
Mm-hmm.
Education and entrepreneurship are their two twin missions, and I don't see them deviating from that. I do think as a foundation also they are trying to figure out where are the high leverage interventions. You know, there's just not enough money around to solve every problem by throwing money at it. We have to be really smart about it, and that's what they're searching for. What are the really smart ways? But I do think they're still focused on education and entrepreneurship.
We're sort of coming to the end of our conversation, but I'm going to throw this out to you sort of selfishly for our own work here at KCUR, but also because I think our listeners will be interested in this. What do the two of you see as the most undercovered and maybe unknown but important lines that divide and unite us in our metro region? Let me start with you, Mr. Collins.
Thanks for starting with me. I was thinking about when Matthew called and talked to me about the issue of dividing lines in this community. And there's been a lot of studies that have talked about the issues in this metropolitan area. And one of them said the big dividing issues in Kansas City are its history, its distance between issues.
Distance between issues.
Distance between areas in the community.
Oh, okay. You mean sprawl, basically.
Sprawl,
uh-huh.
Separation uh-huh. from things, and leadership. And I think one of the things I'd like to talk about is one of the unseen positives that this community has in a lot of cases is our leadership. Because coming not only from the government but from the civic community are great leaders in this community that stand in the Civic Council and the Chamber of Commerce's and Mid-America Regional Council, the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation, that take on these types of issues that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Do they talk to each other enough?
I believe that they talk to each other. They sit on most of the boards. They have taken on these issues for 20, 25 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they are progressing in a number of the areas that we think are important, early childhood education, dealing with growth and development, dealing with transportation, those types of issues.
Frank, you have 30 seconds.
Golly. Well, I would just throw out the population is aging, and that's a huge issue that we're dealing with, and there's sometimes a schism between what's good for the young and what's good for the old. I would also say, though, that the sustainable development, more compact development, seems to be something that everyone is useful for and to create communities for all ages.
Thank you very much, Bob Collins, Frank Lake, Ron Jones, Allison Rollitz. Now to our next segment, whether or not you're Kansas City native or transplant, something called you here or kept you here. That's why Susan Wilson is launching an ongoing series called Going to Kansas City. She'll be sharing the stories of how people came to our area and why they stayed. But first, Susan wanted to explore the origins of that well-known hit song, Going to Kansas City. It was the inspiration for this series. So she met up with our own Fish Fry host, Chuck Haddock, to give a listen. And as it turns out, Kansas City has been a destination for song long before the well-known hit, Going to Kansas City. Susan and Chuck started with Columbia, Missouri-based pianist Blind Boone's Rag Medley No. 2, which was recorded in 1909.
There's only two lyrics included in the song, and the first line says, Carrie's gone to Kansas City. She's done gone, and I'm going too. And that's one of the first songs to establish Kansas City as a destination.
Well, all I can say is Carrie must have been a very persuasive young woman at that time.
I think so.
Then there was a song called Kansas City Blues.
Yeah, that was recorded by Jim Jackson for the Vocalion label in October 1927. This became one of the so-called first big race record hits.
I'm going to move to Kansas City. I'm going to move to Kansas City.
Back in the 1920s, there were these companies, these record companies were called race labels. Black Swan, OK, Paramount, Black Patty. And they manufactured recordings, made recordings, and marketed them specifically to African Americans. Hence, they were called race labels. And this is one of the first big hits. And Jackson's an interesting man. He traveled on the medicine shows and also in minstrel shows. And he had a big hit with Kansas City Blues. And it contains one of the earlier references to rock and roll, too. There's a line in there, quote, "It takes a rocking chair to rock, rubber ball to roll," end of quote.
Five yellow, three black, and one brown. We gon' move to Kansas City.
So then we come to the song that everybody is familiar with, Going to Kansas City. Now, who wrote this song?
It was written by Lieber and Stoller. They published it in December 1952. And it was recorded by Little Willie Littlefield as Kansas City Lovin'. And the thing that this did was it immortalized Kansas City's 12th and Vine. During the 1920s and 1930s, during the heyday of Kansas City jazz, 12th Street stretched for a mile east of downtown. It was lined by taxi dance operations, taxi dance halls, gambling joints. And by 1952, there were still remnants of that kind of what I call the intemperate spirit.
My Kansas City, baby, and I love Kansas City, why?
So how popular did the Going to Kansas City song become? And I guess, what were the most popular versions?
Well, the most popular version was Wilbert Harrison's version of it from 1959. It was recorded for the Fury label, hit number one on the Billboard charts, which was really rare for an R&B record, or soul record at that time. The lyrics were different than Little Willie Littlefield's version. The lyrics were cleaned up so it could be played on Top 40 radio. There's no more reference to leaving his woman, sneaking out while she's sleeping, my old lady won't know I'm gone. And, you know,
all course, the juicy stuff.
And then instead of, they got a crazy way of loving, they talk about they're going to get him a Kansas City woman. They got a crazy way of loving.
Before Wilbert Harrison's rendition, Little Richard did a rendition of Going to Kansas City. But his was a bit different, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. He, Little Richard, it's a rare instance where Little Richard covered a song by another composer. I mean, he was kind of a hit machine in his own right. And in 1955, he recorded a version called Kansas City, Hey, 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 Hey. He recorded Kansas City, but he did it in his own way.
So putting that Little Richard flavor on it.
That's right.
The Beatles also did a version of Going to Kansas City during the British invasion. Do you know anything about what made them pick that song and how it was received?
If you listen to Paul McCartney's vocal style in the early days of the Beatles, he was very much influenced by Little Richard. And the song had been in their repertoire since as early as 1962 at the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany. And they based their performance on Little Richard's performance. Of course, they performed it here in Kansas City when they appeared here at A Stadium in September 1964. And then the next month, they went into the studio and recorded it for their Beatles For Sale album.
You know,
a number of songs reach, you know, that number one spot as Going to Kansas City did, but they don't become a lasting classic. All of them do not. What factors contributed to Going to Kansas City's staying power through the years?
I think Kansas City, like any great song, endures if you can sing along to it. That's the way it's passed on. You know, even those that can't, individuals that can't carry a tune in a basket can sing, you know, Kansas City, here I come. I remember hearing it when it first came out, the 59 version, I was 8 years old. When you heard the song, you know, it instilled civic pride, you know. I remember thinking, well, Kansas City must be a pretty hip place if I'm hearing it on the radio.
Put Kansas City on the map in a way, right?
Yes, definitely. Kansas City, I mean, and it's not just these songs. I did a search on Merlin, which is the online catalog of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. See how many different versions of Kansas City we had. Songs that with just Kansas City in the title, we had 545 different hits. Variations on the song Kansas City, also songs like Kansas City Shuffle, Kansas City Man Blues. There's always been, and I think that also there's been so many references to Kansas City in song because Kansas City, it was a railroad hub, and it was the first stop outside of the Deep South. And while there were Jim Crow, Kansas City was Jim Crow like most big cities. It wasn't nearly as bad as places down south or some of the really hard-knocked cities up north. So Kansas City became a destination for African Americans. That's reflected also in the communities that settled here. At 18th and Vine, the Steptoe community in Westport, the community in Kansas City, Kansas. There was a sense of community because people came here and they settled down. And they could find jobs, too.
Any last words before we stop?
Going to Kansas City, here I come.
All right. Chuck Haddix, thank you for being on our first segment of Going to Kansas City for Central Standard.
Glad to be here. Yeah, I said bye, bye, little baby. Bye, bye, baby. Bye, 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 bye.
Well, we're out of time for today. That was Susan Wilson talking with KCUR's Chuck Haddix. Earlier in the hour, we spoke with Robert Collins, president of Collins, Notice & Associates, and Frank Lent, director of research services at MARC. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page at kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard when we talk about Missouri inmate Michael Taylor, who will be executed this week. Also, author Christopher Leonard will discuss his book about the American meat industry. Central Standard's produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Kate Baxendale. Up to Date is next with a look at some highly unusual and controversial legislation coming from the Kansas State House. That, plus the man behind some of the most iconic Esquire covers. I'm Laura Ziegler, and this is Central Standard on KCUR.